de un apartamental pulga infestado vienen los livings de un hombre encantador. It's Batsigando!
Thank you, Jorge. You've once again helped me see God in the worst way possible. Here's a hint, Jorge. I'm not a religious man. Kids, this is Bat Segundo. As always, my head is booming harder than my illegitimate son's subwoofer. But while a hard Bloody Mary will keep me functioning until happy hour, my plight isn't nearly as tough as Paula Kamen's. Kamen is a journalist who has been suffering from a headache for 14 years. She placed a contact lens into her eye and felt a sharp stabbing pain that wouldn't go away. Her new book, All in My Head, describes her efforts to rid herself of chronic daily headache using doctors, acupuncture, alternative medicine, and pretty much anything that suggested a possible remedy, short of 12 beers. Her memoir is juxtaposed with a history of this underreported condition and makes my problem seem comparatively pedantic. Our young roving correspondent talked with Miss Kamen at the Dolores Park Cafe. Dolores, as we know, is Spanish for pain. Because of this tasteless joke, I promise you that I'm taking steps to thoroughly box our correspondent in the ears.
I'm not sure if this would actually be giving away the end of the book, but in terms of our listeners, in terms of the fact that you have not actually sort of found a cure for your recurrent headache, do you have a headache right now?
Yes, definitely.
On a scale of 1 to 10, what would that headache be?
It's about a 3 or a 4, which is not too bad.
Okay.
So it's weird, but you know, all these different factors converge just to determine about how good it'll be. And today it's a very clear day. A lot of times I feel better on clear days.
Yeah, you wrote that in that cold weather versus hot weather was a factor for you.
Okay, very good. You read the book. Okay.
Yes, I have. Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Yes. So overall, yeah, it's as good as it can get. Probably about a 3-4 out of 10. So we're just—it's a mild annoyance, you know.
Okay. Well, I wanted to—I'll get into the specific sort of chronic headache disorder later. But what I wanted to do first is sort of get a sense of the tone of the book, which is sort of halfway between a memoir and a micro history. And I was wondering—I, for example, found this book in the medical interest section, which is very interesting. I was wondering how you stumbled upon that particular sort of genre, or what you did to sort of, you know, what made you decide to? How did you find the mix for this?
Yeah, it's a weird combination. It's black comedy, memoir, and then I'm a journalist. So it's basically the form follows function that seemed to make sense in terms of what I wanted to convey. But I wanted journalism because there's so little knowledge about chronic pain, especially chronic daily headache, which is the thing that I have. So I wanted to put it in perspective with some reporting, talk to other patients, doctors, because otherwise it would be so easy to make this into a metaphor, you know, just a symbol of what it means, you know, it's my anger or controlling nature or repression or something. So I wanted to explain a lot of the seemingly bizarre stuff that was happening to me and put it in context.
Yeah,
and then it's humor because it was just such a stupid, absurd situation to have a headache nonstop for 14 years.
Sure.
And all the crazy things that you'll do when you're desperate. I mean, like, it doesn't follow any logic, a lot of the stuff that I've done and paid for. Yeah, and then a memoir, obviously to make it more personal, to get people, to see inside the interior life of someone with chronic pain. There's all these hidden dramas that happen, you know, minute by minute that are sort of hidden. So you really have to get into the psyche of somebody who has it to understand it.
You spent a large portion of your 20s with this headache. Do you feel that you missed out on a lot of things? Or?
Yeah, I'm 38 now, and it happened, when I was 24.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's... I feel more sorry for the people who get this in their teenage years. The typical age of onset for a constant headache is between the teens and 20s.
Yeah.
So I'm just grateful I didn't get it earlier, because I don't know how I would have gotten through college. You know, I had a college degree.
Yeah.
And the first part of my career I was able to start without this. So, but yeah, it's a lot. yeah, it's certainly changed every aspect of life.
Well, so. I was also going to ask if you've sort of avoided contact since then, since that's when it first started.
Yes, I'm definitely wearing, yeah these glasses, yeah. These, I'm trying to have fun with it and have, like, fashion glasses, so, but yeah, it's very odd. This started, or it seemed to start when I was putting in contact lenses, and it triggered just one of the worst pains I ever had in my left eye, and it just radiated very strongly backward. And then, of course, I took out the contacts, but then the pain started happening on its own until a few months later it was one constant headache. I'm realizing now that it wasn't the contacts that caused it, but I can see the contacts as sort of triggering it. When you have chronic pain, I guess the nerves become oversensitized over years very slowly. So that's probably the first time that I really noticed it. So I hadn't worn contacts for a while. Maybe if I would have put them in a few months before, I would have had like a little less of a pain, you know. Yes. So it seemed to be caused by it, but it wasn't. It was sort of like the trigger to all those hypersensitive nerves that were brewing.
Well, it's funny because I have never worn contacts myself, and I read this thinking, well, will this happen to me if I actually start wearing contacts?
Yeah, that's one negative thing of starting it off with that story. Yeah, because I am afraid it gives me a misleading impression that contacts cause, will ruin your life. Basically, this is triggered, if I go into a pool by chlorine, any kind of, it's so weird how hypersensitive the nerves are. So obviously it's not the fault of the contact. It's, it's based like deep in the brain somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to get into specifically you're suffering from chronic headache disorder. Is it safe to say, or chronic daily?
The word now is chronic daily headache.
Yeah,
it's sort of a stupid
CCDH,
term.
Yes. I actually dug up a few news articles about what, based off of reading your book, which sort of implied that CDH is this, thing that, a lot of people don't understand. It was only recently diagnosed in 2003, and as you point out in your book.
It's sort of complicated, but basically, in 2004, when they revised the guidelines of the equivalent of the DSM-4 of headaches. It isn't called the DSM-4, but it's something like that with
HSM-4.
Roman numerals. That's when they classified about 8 or 10 types. So before, not officially, it was classified, but this is the first, really comprehensive official classification.
Well, I thought you might get a kick out of some of these particular headlines. Here's an article from ABC News in 2005. The director of the Jefferson Headache Clinic in Thomas Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia. He says, people with chronic daily headache are likely to have family, social, and occupational problems, which perpetuate the headache cycle, and many also suffer occasional or frequent migraines. Yeah, but the thing that is interesting is that it implies that, well, you're going to obviously have sort of family, social, and occupational problems, but I want to sort of continue where I'm going with this. CBS News, 2003. It's really sad because these headaches take all the pleasure out of a life. It's really sad because these headaches take all the pleasure out of life at a time when high school and college students should be enjoying their lives. So we're seeing a theme here that life is, and this is kind of going to the end. And then in an article at Fox News, there's a article that links CDH to obesity, and basically the scientist responds, fascinating, very fascinating, which reminded me of Mr. Spock from Star Trek. In these articles, these various sort of medical authorities are sort of saying that you can't have a life when you are dealing with this chronic daily headache. And I was wondering if you could respond to that about how you have managed to sort of find a life, or as you think that these sort of, medical things, we'll touch upon the drug situation, but I wanted to sort of get the sense from you about, how have you lived a life, or do you think these things are preposterous? Do you think that anyone suffering from this condition can still live a life, or are they forever plagued with family, social, and occupational problems?
Well, I'm going to answer that probably in a way you wouldn't expect, that it was actually it was validating for me doing research for this book to see journal articles like that, because that's the only place where doctors will admit how difficult it is to treat and how what a mother it is, or how horrible it is to have it. That when you see news articles a lot of times, like on the TV news or some short, snappy little article, it's always about how some new drug is curing everybody. And of course, those were initiated by some new drug being invented and the PR machine around that. So for the first decade of this headache, all I read were articles how everyone's getting cured and how nobody has the headache get in the way of their life. So I felt very guilty and shamed and isolated, like I was the only one.
So
this is the only place they'll admit about how tough it is to treat this, is among other doctors. They wouldn't go like in Time magazine saying it, because in Time they're more likely to say you can cure it through all these drugs or it's very treatable, because they want people to go to them as doctors who are reading it. So it's almost like this secret, this like conspiracy of silence, how that for half of the chronic daily headache sufferers, drugs don't work for us. Unfortunately, I'm in that half.
Yeah,
and how hard it is. But as you're sensing, the reality of the experience is probably somewhere in between. That, yeah, it's a real bitch. It's a horrible, the worst thing that ever happened to me. It makes life much more difficult every day. But a lot what I talk about, instead of cure, because most neurological problems cannot be cured, in fact, is how to manage it. So, ironically, after accepting it more as a reality, I've been able to manage it, and it interferes less. It's still an issue, but I've learned how to sort of not be defined by it and move around it. It's not easy.
Well, you have the marbles in the book that
right.
You use. You have a set number of marbles every single day, which sounds to me like someone who is not letting this get in the way of actually living a life.
Yeah, that's true. That you notice, in reading these articles, you might think that the person has no marbles.
Yeah.
Your marbles are what I call like energy units. So like before I got this, before I was 24, I probably had, like more than the average person marbles. Maybe I had like 15 and the average person has 12.
You were like the marble queen on the playground. You go ahead and like take every kid's marble.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where I was the type, to stay up all night writing and it always worked. And I published a book, at 23, 24. And there's never a lot of limits. So now I probably, if the average person maybe has 12, maybe I have about 6. So that's less than I had before. But there's still a lot you can do with 6. And I'm strangely productive, even though I only have 6 marbles, because I guess I'm pretty focused. I have the goal of what I'm doing. And you work on it every day. So it's like I'm a tortoise in the hare, I'm like the tortoise. So you just keep going, and then eventually it adds up.
Well, like for example, like if you were to use a half marble, what would you do with a half marble, or what would you do with 2 marbles? What tasks? I kind of want to get a sort of a monetary denomination value of the marble here.
Yeah, I'm forgetting exactly what I wrote in the book, but calling someone back, depending on who they are, it could be a half to 2 marbles. Traveling, it takes a lot of marbles. I just drove from Berkeley here. Well, maybe see that was about 2 of my marbles for the day.
Okay.
So, and there are fewer because I've been traveling. So maybe today I have 5 marbles. After this, I have nothing planned. I'm just going to go back and do nothing. So.
Do you have an emergency marble that you reserve?
Yeah, you're actually able to mortgage some, but you always pay with more. You always pay with interest. So, there are days where it's inevitable when I'm traveling that I push myself to have like a 10, 12 marble day, but then the next day I might be dead. You'll have like 2 marbles the next day or something.
So there's a marble surplus that sometimes carries over from one day to the next.
Right. Okay. But like I said, there's interest. Yeah, you pay for it. So, it's a constant battle. It's a tough thing, but I guess I accept, too, there's going to be days where I'm tired out and more pain, and that's just a part of life, so that reduces some of the anxiety. That's just the way, if you're going to live in the world, you're going to have more pain on those days. So.
Well, I wanted to sort of touch upon what you were saying earlier about, the doctors who were throwing drugs at the problem. We'll get into that a little bit more, but I wanted to specifically talk about how you're obviously very self-aware of this problem, and obviously because you're feeling it, and you've also developed this marble idea. How do you think that this sort of, really intricate sort of self-awareness has sort of prevented doctors from diagnosing it? If you could sort of touch upon that maybe a little bit.
Or what do you mean about that?
By really sort of in your book, you describe, particularly towards the end, You describe doctors who are not able to, they just basically are not asking you the specific sort of, you know, symptoms or exactly what you're feeling and things like that. They're just sort of like, oh, well, here you go. Here's a drug. Here's some Xanax.
Shut up and take the Xanax.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was wondering, and then, of course, there's the one report midway through the book where the one doctor has written this manifesto, what you describe as a legal brief, you know, that it has, and it's more of a sort of a psychological profile.
It's in my folder to sort of protect him. You know, this is what I did, and this is my, you know, just to, you know, leave a paper trail for his benefit. Yeah.
But I guess where I'm going with this is, it seems to me that the concentration here is more psychological in scope rather than physical in scope. And I was wondering if you can explain if. Do you think your self-awareness or your communicative abilities to these respective medical authorities has something to do with that, or?
Well, it's less now that I'm more aware. I didn't realize in the beginning that they were giving me covert psychiatric exams when I was going in. Like, I didn't realize that just bringing my mom in, this is in my mid-20s, bringing my mom, and I was feeling really bad. Yeah. You know, that was automatically a red flag for them that I was a dependent personality and these headaches were a part of that, you know, to get financial support for my parents.
Even though you go in on Mother's Day or something.
So I actually have a list of advice to patients of what to do when you go into a doctor. Like, wear a wedding ring even if you're not married, because that seems like you're more normative if you're married.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're... don't tell them, if you're not totally straight, don't tell them that, keep that a secret. If you're a woman, be as feminine as possible, wear a skirt and, you know, full makeup and everything. But, because I used to just go in, just like roll out of bed for some morning appointment looking terrible, you know, because I was just feeling so bad. In the morning, I feel worse. So I didn't realize, that would influence them to say, oh, well, she's... I mean, I didn't say this in my chart, but your appearance means a lot.
Yeah.
Sadly, so.
Wow. Well, like, in what way would you say?
Yeah, they're constantly trying to see how normative you are, and anything that deviates at all from the female norm is an indictment that you're nuts and that the pain is a result of you being nuts.
So if you've got an earring, a nose piercing.
Take that out. Take out that nose piercing if you don't want to end up, on Valium, you know, on a high dose of Valium or something.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
I mean, this is all a throwback to the Freudian days, to the 50s and 60s when Freud was all the rage, especially, define pain purely psychologically.
Yeah.
You know, and the person had a motive, often subconscious, for holding on to the pain.
Yeah.
So they're always trying to guess your motive, your secret motive for having the pain. So hopefully this will diminish, because now through science, there's much more advanced brain scans now that actually show the pain on the scans. I mean, I'm sort of boiling it down. It's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah.
But they have these PET scans, functional MRIs, and so on the highest levels of neurology, you don't see this covert psychiatric exam. It's more like, on the lower levels, or like doctors who went to medical school, like in the 60s or the 70s. So, but yeah, it's a weird thing to have to worry about. So now I'm much more savvy. Yeah, where I arrive there, I'm dressed up and coiffed and everything, and no mom.
Well, the thing that really you're touching upon here, and I'll get into the women's issues later, because that's also a very important component, but CDH, it seems to me that the understanding, even from the medical people, is that the psychological and the physical sort of overlap, that there's no distinction between the two. And your book sort of tries to sort of set that there is, in fact, a distinction, that there is, in fact, physical validity.
Right.
I mean, CDH has only recently sort of, you know, as we discussed, recently been recognized. What do you think could be done to sort of make it clear to these people that, you know, look, you know, the CDH that I experience is in fact physical. It's not some figment of my imagination, you know.
Yeah, actually, this is more easier said than done, but we need much more nuanced reporting.
Yeah.
But the reality is, I mean, I didn't know this till after a year of research on this book, that there is a high correlation between depression and chronic daily headache.
The comorbidities you mentioned.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I didn't know what that meant, comorbidity, what that means.
It sounded like some really bad
cousin
horrible. Of codependent or something.
Yeah. Yeah, but I was actually thrilled. Oh, I have comorbidities. That's good news for me because it explains... In fact, a lot of us, do have anxiety and depression, but a reason is that it's similar underlying brain chemistry imbalances. So it's not because you're depressed, so then you invent the headache, as a way to manifest your sorrow at the world or something. It's more like there is some similar brain chemistry. So that's a reason, for chronic pain, that a very common treatment is to take antidepressants. It isn't because you're depressed, but it's similar neurotransmitters.
Yeah.
Involved with it, so it's complicated. Yeah, that often in the reporting, there's just a big story in psychology today talking about how chronic fatigue is all in your head, and as proof, it listed studies how chronic fatigue people are more likely to have had stressful events in their life. So that's sort of oversimplifying.
Yeah.
That when you have the stress, it can physiologically make your brain more reactive, and then you. Oh, can become more vulnerable to chronic fatigue, but that doesn't mean that chronic fatigue isn't a neurological problem. So
it strikes me as really interesting because, the brain is probably the most misunderstood of all the organs in medicine. And yet, here we are, a recent sort of phenomenon, or at least not necessarily recent, but recently sort of finally it's in the books. And yet, we're still sort of like, oh, it's all in your head. It's still very much like some sort of, Victorian hysteria, so to speak.
Yeah, it's so crazy. Yeah, 2005, this is still going on.
Yes.
I mean, and it's almost some of the last parts of Freudianism that still rage on because it's neurological, so it's invisible. So we're able to put all these metaphors to it. And it mainly happens to women, not to get all radical feminist, radical feminist on you. But this is a majority of women have chronic pain disorders, so naturally it's dismissed, it's hormones or a stress headache or whatever.
Well, there's also the chapter in the book that if you are a man who does have this, that in fact, when it comes to the so-called, not tonight, honey,
right.
I have a headache, actually the guy is screwed, no pun intended. And it's actually, it releases endorphins and sex is actually very beneficial for someone who suffers from this particular syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the serotonin, endorphins. Yeah, they've actually done studies, you can believe it, that show that sex could help headaches. But ironically, men are more likely than women to get sex-related migraine. There's actually such a thing.
Yeah.
But there's no Freudian explanation about that. It's interesting. When the man gets a headache from sex, there's no elaborate theories that he's repressed or frigid or blah blah, so there's no meaning attached to it. It's all neurological.
Sure. Well, going back to sort of this a psychiatric background in terms of Freud, you also take on, there's a chapter where you take on a number of various people, including Oliver Sacks, book Migraine, where could you just sort of kind of go describe that? I wanted to sort of, jump off there, but go for it.
Yeah, I was surprised because I had a whole stack of books I wanted to read for this, and one of them was Oliver Sacks' Migraine that was originally written, I think, in 1970 or the early 70s, and I couldn't wait to read it. I was thinking that would be a more fun part of doing the book. I'd sit, under an Afghan with a hot, mug of hot cocoa, and so I was in shock opening it up, and he talks about headaches, especially when you have them all the time, that it's definitely... a dependent personality, that you have a motivation, especially when it's more constant and influences your life more. So his original edition in 1970 said that most headaches had a hidden motivation, but then he revised it in the 90s. I thought, in the revision, in the new intro, he'll apologize for that. But actually, he said, well, now I think that migraine is real, but when you have, it every day, that's not real.
Yeah.
So this was in the early 90s that he updated it and only apologized for just some of the episodic migraines, the same that they're psychosomatic. Because in the years since his first edition, there's been a lot of good migraine drugs. So ironically, when you have a good drug for something, that proves it as real.
Yeah.
So depression was really, but depression was really validated a lot by Prozac because you take something you know that's chemical, then you're not depressed. It shows it's a chemical imbalance. So the same thing has happened in the last 20 years with episodic migraine.
But
because there's good drugs for it, or better drugs.
But with CDH so misunderstood, even in 2005, do you think it's entirely fair to sort of go after Sachs because he subscribes to the hard line? This hard line that totally fails to actually take into account that CDH is more than just some psychosomatic BS, you know? That in fact is a very sort of palpable physical thing that many people deal with.
Right. Well, I'm not too, I don't have too much hatred toward Oliver Sacks because a lot of what he said comes out of this very part of his environment, you know, as a neurologist of a certain age, you know, where you learn that, but he represents this whole movement, you know, different guys that I profiled in that chapter who are real, who had huge influence in how we view migraine. Yeah, a lot of them come from this real Freudian school. Yeah, they represent a lot of people, so it isn't just them.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of Freud's disciples were much worse than him.
Yeah.
So reading, it was the first time I ever read Freud, and I was surprised that it wasn't, in some cases, it wasn't that extreme.
Yeah.
I mean, and Freud himself had migraines, so he saw it as real.
Yeah.
So yeah, a lot of his disciples, you know, like, took it to a much greater extreme, you know, saying all pain is psychological and stuff.
Well, you're... In your book, you don't take an entirely favorable view towards doctors for understandable purposes. But going back to this question of whether it's, do you think that it's sort of the HMO sort of atmosphere that we have, or is it the doctor's mentality? What do you think sort of fuels this kind of approach to, you know, going ahead and not denying a major illness here?
I mean, there's a whole conspiracy here of forces that.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, number one, women mainly get this, so it's easy to deny that I just met a male chronic daily headache sufferer who's a white, rich lawyer, and he said he goes to the doctor, and they complain about all these women who have stress headaches, but they tell him that he has real headaches. You know, they give him whatever morphine he wants, and he's a conservative guy. He said, I'm glad I'm not a woman because I'm able to get, you know, these strong drugs that I need.
So basically they give him, like, you know, without any sort of real sort of probing, they just give him all the drugs?
He's a lawyer. He's a professional.
Yeah.
He's their peer, so they basically say whatever you need, and he has even worse than I do. He has cluster headaches, which are the most painful headache possible. He has it nonstop or every day.
The cluster headache being the one with the guy in the elevator.
Right. Yeah, that's the worst. Yeah. You know, the biggest, what I have is like a mosquito bite.
Yeah.
Yeah, where it's common. It's mainly men who get it, ironically, but it's a very small percentage of men. And it's often accompanied by tearing and by hitting your head on the wall because that's better sensation than the pain you have, ironically.
Yeah.
But he has extremely high doses of narcotics, but he said he has no problem to get them. Yeah, and studies have shown that women with the same pain are much more likely to get tranquilizers, you know, and not painkillers, you know. To just sort of get rid of them. But is it so there's that, but it's mainly women.
Yeah.
It's invisible neurologically. And then to treat it, you need a lot of time to treat pain. Everyone's different.
Mm-hmm.
So I react different to different treatments. You know, someone else would. So you need lots of time. And the way medicine is set up, obviously, it's just you're in and out, you know, and they just give you something. They don't ask. They don't tell you how to take it, you know, like make sure to... You know, start gradually, and so that's a horrible thing. I'm trying to think of there's so many other forces that make it bad. Yeah, and we're annoying. And people who have pain are hard to treat.
Yeah.
So a lot of times you just want to get rid of the person. So I've had doctors like break up with me, you know, but sort of covertly. So they just don't want to deal with you anymore. And it's sort of ridiculous because they should recognize that there are tough things. But I've talked to doctors and it's so strange how they see that tough patient as an indictment of them.
Yeah.
So I'm not just a patient with something that's tough to treat. I'm in their face saying you're inadequate. So that's kind of stupid. There has to be more ego.
It deflates their sort of expertise in this. They're supposed to have all the answers.
Exactly.
And here's a problem that and a serious affliction that can't be solved.
Right. Yeah, if there's no admission that some things are just hard to treat.
Yeah.
And so it's actually the fault of the patient and the doctor, where we think the doctor should know everything.
Yeah.
And then it's a bit for the doctor of having this huge ego to have to have always have the appearance that he or she can do anything. So if he or she can't, then immediately the patient is indicted for being crazy or whatever.
Well, if you were to write a sequel to this book, it would seem to me that your theme would be, well, what creates this mentality? What creates this sort of, I must solve the problem, and I can't necessarily continuously study and research a problem until we find a solution, you know? It's like, it's interesting to me because you compare like CDH next to something like AIDS. There's all this research for AIDS and everything because it's more sort of in the public eye, and it's a more sort of sympathetic sort of thing from a medical standpoint.
It's more deadly.
It's a more mortal disease. But does the mortality of the disease actually make it less important?
It does make it less important. I mean, and I understand a reason for that, too. They always say the good news and the bad news about chronic daily headache or chronic fatigue is that it won't kill you. That's the good and the bad news. So I recently went to a new neurologist. She'd been highly recommended as a really nice neurologist. And I got in there, and she asked about family history. And actually, my sister had cancer, which was hard, and I mentioned that. So she said, boy, it puts everything you're going through in perspective.
Yeah.
So it's true, it does, but then I also felt like she was belittling it as it means, it doesn't really mean that much, and it's not lethal.
What cancer patient goes through 14 years,
nonstop. Nonstop. Yeah, like a weird, I mean, this is, believe me, you'll never win comparing suffering. Yeah. But I'll often like go to a party and I'm suffering, and then I'll see like someone's parent is going through chemo and they're much more energetic. Yeah, than I am, or they have a full-time job, and I mean, it was not to diminish anyone's suffering by any stretch of the imagination,
life is not a comparison of chamber of horrors, you know?
Right, exactly, but in reality, this is the end of the book, that unfortunately pain can be deadly, that there is a relatively high suicide rate in people with chronic pain, that half the people who commit suicide have chronic pain.
Wow.
So that's how they talk about depression. Of course, depression's not deadly in itself, but
there's also lost productivity. I mean, every single time I read that, something is the sort of playing footsie there. Every time I read an article that sort of blames the internet or something else, or public transportation being late translates into X amount of dollars for lost productivity. But you can make the same argument for this, how much lost productivity is being lost from people who suffer from chronic pain.
They have quantified that.
Exactly.
Like bazillions and it's incredible. Yeah, all the lost days of work.
Well, you also touch upon the disability system and how you're only allotted $550 a day if you could even get it.
A month.
I'm sorry. My eyes were thinking big there.
If you can get it, it's actually. Ironically, it's harder to get disability for chronic pain than for depression because there's been a big depression lobby.
Yeah.
Even though they're both invisible. So, so if you can get it, an average, the people I've interviewed have gotten like between 500 and maybe 1,000.
Yeah.
So, a month, is very difficult, obviously. A lot of the disability system, it's based on if it's visible.
Yeah.
So, like, to document it with x-rays or other things. So what you have to do, like, depression people have taught us, you have to have a paper trail with doctors. You have to keep all your medical records. Actually, go to doctors because then that leaves a paper trail that you have something. But, and it's also a different concept of disability when it's invisible, because a big way that we could help people participate in life is to allow them to go at a slower pace. The concept of pace is really essential with a visible disability. And it's sort of harder to grasp. I'll give you the example. If I'm in a wheelchair, my life becomes less disabled if you build a ramp.
Yeah.
For me, then I can get to work.
Yeah.
If I have chronic daily headache, I'm less disabled if, say, I'm able to have a shorter work day or a more flexible work day. So that's something that's sort of harder for people to get their mind around, you know.
And yet the American Disabilities Act has made ramps completely everywhere for a percentage of the population that is, you know, comparatively small, you know, if you actually, if you look at it that way, too.
Right.
I mean, yet we're also not a particularly sort of welfare-friendly society these days. You know, the Welfare Reform Act of 1996 completely, you know, obliterated, you know, welfare to work programs. So in order for you to actually get help, you have to make, if you're a single mother on top of that, it's totally difficult. I can only ponder how someone who suffers from CDH would, you know, is also a mother, you know?
Yeah, I can't imagine that. Yeah. Yeah, overall, they've done studies, and people who do have chronic daily headache.
Or a father, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they do have lower income, lower education.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a stereotype of these kind of things, like chronic fatigue, chronic pain, as being, oh, just like white upper middle class women who are like belly gazing and picking on every little, you know, problem. But in reality, well, I can speak for chronic daily headache. And mainly, it's more prominent among poorer people, less educated. Some of that could be a vicious cycle, where you're in a lot of pain, so you can't finish college, and then you get a lower-paying job. But it's been a huge, it's been very eye-opening that if I didn't have middle-class parents, I don't know what would have happened to me, to be honest.
Well, I should also point out that in your book, you actually do have a sidebar where you specifically single out, hey, I just happened to be one of the lucky ones, you know?
Ironically, I don't know what would have happened to me. I mean, I'm not from a rich family. My dad was a professor, you know, but not poor family.
Yeah.
So he was able to pay my health insurance, and there's no way, it's a very expensive health insurance, or private, someone who will take me with a pre-existing condition.
Gotcha.
So he pays for that, and then there were times when I was all zoned out on drugs, I couldn't write, and I couldn't even do a temp job. So, I don't know what would have happened to me.
You said that you were demoted, actually, from receptionist.
That's very depressing. I went to a temp job thinking, well, I'll do temp work. And then I got demoted to the mailroom because, I wasn't able to keep up with the phone calls as a receptionist.
Now, during the course of your research, did you talk with people who were, like, working class who were suffering from this?
Yeah, definitely.
When did you find their sort of life circumstances to be?
I went on a support group. I interviewed people from there, and they ended up being a lot more working class people. It just ended up that way. But an interesting thing is they're very educated about their illness. So with the internet, they really knew so much. You know, like following the latest studies, they knew about comorbidities, about different classes of drugs. So there's a stereotype that you might not be so educated and informed.
But if they don't have health care, how can they get help? That's the question.
Right. Yeah. So a lot of them were on disability. Living very, very, very frugal lives. You're living in a bad neighborhood in a studio apartment, and that's and not doing much. Like someone with a disability though who's married and on some family farm in a rural area where it's cheaper to live. A lot of struggling, but usually there's like a spouse that helps or something. But very difficult. My last book, ironically, was on young women's sexual attitudes called Her Way.
Yeah.
But a lot of that was a feminist perspective about how we have a greater sense of entitlement to be more open and have less shame. And I think that carries over, ironically, into this chronic pain issue that someone like me, you're raised to have less shame overall. So why should this be different? Why would I be comfortable, say, if I were a single mother and, you know, be open about that, but then not about my headache?
Yeah.
You know? Positive, as I see more younger women talking about this. There's a new website called chronicbabe.com.
Chronic Babe.
Yeah, and it's for the hip, young, and chronic. And you wouldn't have seen this even 5 or 10 years ago. I think it's part of the same movement that my book is a part of, where you feel a sense of entitlement to not be shamed about something. That's a part of being human.
Yeah.
So why should I be shamed about having chronic pain when millions of people have it?
Yeah. So I was going to ask, when you were writing this book, I know you spent 5 years on the Sex and Young Woman book.
Yeah.
But with this, were your editors aware of your condition? Did they give you sort of a certain leeway? Or did you have any problems? Or?
Yeah, it's ironic. Well, actually, it was 8 years total with the sex book.
Yeah.
That was when going through the worst crisis of the headache. You being all drugged up and not being able to write.
Yeah, yeah.
But with this, I had it better managed, and I had more acceptance. Ironically, with more acceptance, it was less controlling of me. So I know I have 6 marbles, so working on the book will be 3 or 4 marbles. So I just plan on that, and I didn't take any drugs at all. See, the main obstacle was the drugs that I was on. Yeah. So, but I didn't know any other way at that time. I always thought that they were about to kick in and work. Yeah, so I was actually pretty efficient. Even for someone without pain, it was still relative. I mean, it was. I still like cranked this one out. Yeah, it was a few years total.
Gotcha.
But I also got better advanced, so I was able to do less other jobs while I was doing it. And,
but in terms of like an actual turn in time for the book, you know, were they flexible on that?
No. Or, no? They obviously knew I had this.
Yeah.
I mean, they weren't mean about it, but it was a pretty set deadline given what they wanted. But I had a different attitude internally that. I mean, I saw it as very important, but if I didn't make it, I know that my health is more important, you know, so if, God forbid, they would have rejected me,
yeah,
and maybe give back the advance, I would have thought, well, I'll just sell it to someone else, you know, it's not worth my health. For the book on sex, I thought, you know, if they don't accept this, my career is over, you know, sort of added to the pressure and the anxiety. So I sort of let myself off the hook, you know, like the health is the most important thing.
So with this, you actually met the deadline.
Yeah, ironically.
Okay. Wow.
So yeah, that's
See,
how
you can manage your marbles right.
Yeah, it's an art form. I'm still learning a lot, but yeah, it'll be a lifetime thing to learn how to manage this. So.
Now I read somewhere that basically Jane Pauley didn't want to put you on the air because there was no cure for this. Is this true? What, can you explain this?
I didn't realize I was going to be in the article in Salon. Yeah, the reporter was just talking to me before.
Oh,
so
yeah.
What kind of publicity have you gotten? I'm like, well, not too much, because I have no cure.
Huh.
At that point, I mean, we had gotten some, but I got a call from one of the producers of that show, and she was surprised I didn't have any cure. So she was thinking that would just be too depressing.
Yeah.
But the fact is, that this is not curable.
Yeah.
And most people live with something that they have to accept.
Yeah.
So there is this conspiracy of silence then about living with difficult things.
That just fascinates me that they demand a fairy tale ending to their news, you know, and well, you could actually affect a long-term fairy tale ending if you actually let people know that this exists.
Yeah, I've been shocked that I get all these grateful emails almost every day from people. I'm surprised. Do you think people would be depressed at the end?
Yeah.
But then it's like, I have this. I feel so validated for the first time. I see you, who's been productive. I see that I can still, you know, make the best of my life in an imperfect situation. So in some ways, that could be more inspiring, that even if something really shitty happens to you, your life's not over.
Yeah.
It sort of reduces anxiety. Yeah, that, I mean, that if something goes wrong, you can still deal with it and move on, basically. So to me, that's more reassuring than like the message that you have to go win 7 Tour de France's and, you know, like do some incredibly heroic.
Yeah.
Feet. So it's not to make fun of Lance Armstrong. He's great, but that's the narrative that everybody wants. It's his narrative, you know, overcoming against the odds, a total cure.
The sort of incompatible reality Hollywood movie approach to news here. Wow.
Exactly. Yeah, that happens with memoirs too. Yeah. I couldn't find any memoirs where someone actually lives with something. So it's actually a miracle that my book was published. I must have a brilliant agent to sell this.
Well, that's the other thing, too, the stigma against memoirs. There was the New York Times article, which by William Grimes, where he basically said, you know, enough already. And he even cited your book without reading
it. He has a prime example of how there's too many memoirs.
What do you have to say to sort of, you know, is your story... How did you sort of corral yourself that your story is worth telling when right now the market is really saturated with memoirs?
Right. Yeah, I mean, believe me, I had a lot of stigma myself against memoir because I'm training as a journalist.
Yeah.
I've written about feminism in the 90s and hadn't seen basically any journalistic books on feminism and just saw memoirs by young women and thought, you know, where is all the politics? But now... I see a bigger point of view that a lot of memoirs by younger women have helped to bring women into feminism by making it more personal.
Sure.
You need both. Yeah, you need the memoir. You need like the overtly political reporting and social criticism. So yeah, I don't see it as one or the other.
Yeah.
And then I tried also. a big problem with memoirs, and I've been annoyed, is when people think that they're a representative of everybody, like of their generation. You know, like if they grew up in some elite community and went to an Ivy League school, oh, I'm my generation.
Yeah.
You're not. So I constantly tried to recognize, like any privileges with health, you know, not assuming everybody's parents could buy them expensive health insurance, you know.
Or either that. The other thing is you have to live some ridiculous life like James Frey, like, you know, rotting in an alley, or both your parents dying within a week of each other, you know. It's like now, in order for you to tell your story effectively, the existential, you know, requirements now are just like, yeah, you almost have to plan them, and you can't. You
know? Right, and for women especially, you have to. I made fun of that a little bit. For a woman, you have to be like totally promiscuous.
Yes, I
bulimic.
Know.
Yeah, like some weird bodily stuff you have to have. Yeah. So actually, yeah.
You have to sleep with your father or your teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It has to have some titillating things.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
actually, one huge publisher said that they didn't want me because it didn't have enough of that. So I felt kind of bad about myself. Yeah, I haven't had an exciting enough personal life.
So that's why the sex
life.
Chapter was in there. I'm not going to reveal anything totally about myself, but just so you know, here are the statistics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the, if you're a woman, you're writing a memoir. Yeah, and your looks matter a lot. Yeah, you get to have like some seductive photo of yourself.
Well,
you know,
there's like that
Elizabeth Wurzel or
the Susan Orlean cover. You know, it's just ridiculous. You know,
right?
Like she's just like humped over, like, you know, with a hat. It's just like, come on.
Yeah, you have to be like this lethargic waif, this tragic waif, which I'm not. But so that actually it has been an issue. But so I sort of make fun of that a little bit.
Yeah.
But it does seem like pain and disability is a worthy topic, yet not too self-indulgent. And it just seems like if something's written well, even if you're writing about something that's not so profound, if you're writing about your pet gerbil, but if you write it in a cool way, I think it's worthy. Yeah, I think no one could say something is not worthy. And ironically, that New York Times writer, he wrote a memoir about a chicken in his backyard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and then also ironically, in that article, he wrote about Ulysses S. Grant as an example of a worthwhile memoir. But Ulysses S. Grant wrote in detail about his headaches.
Are we talking the ones that may have been ghostwritten by Mark Twain? See, that's the other thing.
Oh.
Yeah. There's you know, debate about whether Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs were actually ghostwritten by Mark Twain.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, so
that's funny.
And
so
Twain actually suffered from migraines occasionally too, I think. In terms of psychosomatic pain, which your book deals specifically with genuine physical chronic pain, how can we sort of develop a way to determine the difference between the two?
That's a very good question. Again, this is very nuanced.
Yeah.
It's often not explained well in the media. You know, we have this luxury now with this long interview, to talk about this. That there's a big confusion between stress as a trigger or a cause. And this is probably one of the number one fallacies. That a confusing thing is that stress often triggers pain. But the pain itself is neurological, so it's easy to see that as purely psychosomatic. You know, like say I went through a divorce and my migraines are really bad. It's easy to see that as purely psychosomatic. But the truth is I have to have that genetic predisposition to migraines to begin with. I mean, it gets more confusing if someone's only trigger is stress. You know,
yeah.
See, I only get a migraine in a stressful situation, so it could seem purely, purely psychosomatic.
Sure.
So I'm sure there are people where it is purely psychosomatic, but I don't think it's like the majority. And it's always important to this concept of stress as a trigger rather than a root cause of things. Yeah, that basically migraine, chronic daily headache, they call it a genetic disease with environmental triggers. So it makes it extra confusing.
Yeah.
So, because with some people, I can stress them out to the brink, and they would never get a migraine or a headache.
Well, there's also the comorbidities.
Exactly.
Where if they can sort of, I mean, if they had sort of a way to sort of like say, okay, this person is suffering from, you know, bipolar disorder, if there was a way to sort of check to see if they were suffering also from CDH, then maybe, you know, if this was actually sort of ingrained where the comorbidities are tied in with the other sort of syndromes, it would just, I think it would make everyone's life a lot more easier, you know?
Right, but that's too nuanced of a concept to get in the media about comorbidity, which means similar brain chemistry underlying these things. Yes, I mean, it's much... Yeah, yeah. And even for a lot of doctors, that's too complicated. Like, oh, you're bipolar and have a headache. It's obviously caused by your depression. It's not real.
Yeah.
I mean, I just read a book by a very prominent doctor about pain. It was in the New York Times a few years ago. And as proof about headaches being a lot largely psychological, he cited stats from patients who are bipolar who have a lot of headaches. Mm-hmm. So that's proof that the headaches are not real. But really, it doesn't consider this comorbidity factor that, of course, they're more likely because it's similar underlying brain chemistry.
Huh.
You know, so it's not an indictment of headaches is not real. You know, it's...
Yeah.
So even doctors don't know about that. I didn't know about it until I read, you know, medical journals and went to medical conferences.
Well, I didn't know what a comorbidity was until I read your books.
Okay. Yeah, it's just like a basic concept yet to understand this and not blame the victim.
Yeah.
Thank you, Paula Kamen. Coming next time, when it comes to reporting the war, is the media doing its job, or is it dancing the same old dance and repeating the same old song? Insert your metaphor of choice and find out when we talk with media critic Norman Sullivan. Until next time, I'm heading to the pub, and I hope you are doing the same.